Welcome to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein on Prairie Public. Darren Langrud is the director of the North Dakota Atmospheric Resources Board, a quasi-judicial, quasi-legislative advisory and rulemaking board under the supervision of the State Water Commission, which has oversight over the state's cloud seeding programs. Director Langrud, that's exactly what we would like to talk about today. Welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. I think there is a lot of science and maybe a lot of things that are misunderstood about North Dakota's water seeding programs, and I wanted to afford you the opportunity to help us all understand what cloud seeding is and also what it isn't. And I think the best place to start is the history of cloud seeding. Other states call it weather modification here in North Dakota.
Well, North Dakota was one of the early adopters of cloud seeding, dating all the way back to the early 1950s. There was some work with some funding from the Bureau of Reclamation to do ground-based seeding operations for trying to enhance precipitation over parts of the western part of the state. After some of that experimentation, plains became the preferred method of seeding about by 1960. Shortly thereafter, the state legislature passed some laws regulating how cloud seeding should be conducted in North Dakota in 1965, and then again in 1975, it established the board that I currently work for here in the state that regulates activities for cloud seeding.
So, Darren, this project has advanced well beyond the research phase, and I ask that question because some other states have just kind of made that migration, if you will, to an operational phase more recently, but really it's been operational here in North Dakota for quite a while.
It has been. You know, those early days, like I'd mentioned, were mostly experimental. There were programs here and there over those years in different areas. The state also conducted a pilot project called the North Dakota Pilot Project, oddly enough, in the late 60s and early 1970s, mostly in the western part of the state. And that was kind of the jumping off point. After the results of that four-year randomized program were found that indicated increases in precipitation for seeded clouds versus non-seeded clouds and indicated less hail for seeded clouds than non-seeded clouds, that was kind of the foundation for the jumping off point from the research to starting operations in North Dakota.
Some states, Director, have used these cloud seeding programs to enhance snow and precipitation in wintertime. That's not the case in North Dakota, correct?
Correct. The program in North Dakota has always been a summertime program. It's primarily, you know, utilized to benefit agriculture. That was the original intent of the program, and that's still the intent today. So we're not doing any wintertime operations in North Dakota. What the program here is focusing on is summer thunderstorms, trying to enhance precipitation from those storms and to try to reduce the damaging hail that falls from them sometimes.
And I learned about the damaging hail component of the cloud seeding program, ironically, when I was at the Mindora musical a couple years ago. Some ranchers and farmers were just sitting behind us talking about that. How successful is it? And is that adapted all across the state of North Dakota? Are there just certain communities or counties that are more concerned about hail mitigation? Where is that used to mitigate hail?
Well, the counties that are in the program right now, there are five of them. So we have McKenzie, Mount Trail, Williams County in the northwestern part of the state, Bowman County, and part of Slope County in the southwest. And the goal of the program is twofold. It's to try to mitigate hail impacts to crops and also to enhance summertime precipitation. So those two goals work hand in hand. The goal here for hail suppression is trying to reduce the size and number of hailstones that fall from those clouds that can produce hail. It doesn't need to be very large hail sometimes to produce crop damage if you have a lot of wind with it. So there are other complicating factors, but that is the primary goal of the program, the dual purpose of hail reduction and rain increase.
How successful is the hail reduction component of the program?
Independent studies have looked at that here in North Dakota over the last, you know, several decades that the program has been ongoing. And studies have shown, looking at crop hail insurance data, that the seeding program has been able to reduce crop hail damage in the seeded areas by up to 45%, lower than what it would be in comparative areas upwind where no seeding has been done.
Director, what is the seeding agent that is used and what is the science behind it?
Yes, the silver iodide is the primary seeding agent that's used for cloud seeding, not only here, but pretty much anywhere that cloud seeding is conducted, you know, in the U.S. and around the world, for instance. And the reason that it works so well, it's very effective at producing ice and clouds. And what we're trying to do with cloud seeding, the main goal here is to coax clouds to initiate the precipitation process sooner in their life cycles. We do this by putting these tiny silver iodide particles into clouds that help convert what's called supercooled water. And these are water droplets or water vapor that's in the cloud. They're colder than the freezing temperature, but they're still in a liquid state. And what they need is a template for them to form onto to produce an ice crystal. And silver iodide is extremely good at providing that template. And we're hoping to accelerate the precipitation process and make more efficient use of the water in the cloud through that method.
Obvious question for some who have not followed cloud seeding programs is, how do we know that agent is safe?
So there have been several studies that have looked at the safety of cloud seeding, primarily focused on silver iodide, as that is the major material that's used on these programs. And the published scientific literature shows that there are no harmful environmental effects from cloud seeding to the environment or to humans. The silver iodide material is used in extremely small quantities. There are programs in the western states that do snow core samples after seeding to try to determine if they're able to target the seeding material in the clouds where they want it to fall out. And by taking those samples and then bringing it back to a lab, they can run the snow through their instrumentation and they can find the silver in the snow. Sometimes it's a little bit above background, but there's already background silver in the environment. And we're talking about amount of silver in the parts per trillion range. So very, very, very minute amounts of silver. They can find the silver in the snow, but it's a very, very low amount of silver that they can find.
Where is it impactful relative to where the silver iodide is placed? In other words, is it immediate or does it happen downrange wherever the wind blows, maybe 10, 15, 20 miles? Once a cloud is seeded, when does it expect to produce more precipitation?
It depends on a number of variables of the clouds that are being seeded, how fast they're moving, how quickly precipitation is developing in those clouds. But in a general sense, for summertime, if you're putting the material in at the base of the cloud and allowing for the updraft of the cloud to bring it up to the part of the storm where you're encountering supercooled water, that might take 15 to 20 minutes to get that process started. Other options are to put the material directly into the cloud at higher altitudes, and then your process begins much more quickly. Once that happens, then those particles continue to grow, and eventually they become too fall to be held up by the updrafts in the cloud, and they fall out as precipitation. You know, between that 10 to 15 minute range, probably to get things started, and maybe upwards of a half an hour or so to work its way through the cloud system, cloud seeding programs take that into effect and into account, and they'll be seeding further upwind depending on those conditions. So when they expect the effect to start to affect the precipitation falling out of the cloud, that it will be falling in the target area range that they're wanting to put it in.
We are enjoying our conversation with Darren Langrud, the director of the North Dakota Atmospheric Resources Board. Director, how much more precipitation is expected when a system has been seeded? In other words, what does the data show?
Yeah, so for North Dakota, again, there have been several studies that have looked at the effects of precipitation increases coming from cloud seeding. We're seeing, of those several studies, they range from the low single digits to the low double digits percentage increase. Generally in the 5 to 10% range is kind of what we're finding. So that might not sound like a lot, but 5 to 10% additional rainfall over a 3-month period during the growing season might mean, you know, a third of an inch to a half an inch of additional precipitation, and that does have an impact on crop yields.
Is there a value that has been placed then on the additional water relative to the cost of the program? Have you looked at how those two come together?
Yeah, so we've worked with North Dakota State University's Agricultural Economics Department. They did a study just recently in 2019 that looked at what are the crop yield impacts ranging from 5 to 10% additional rainfall and also a reduced damage from hail. And what they found was that if rainfall is increased by 5%, the lower end of the range, the agricultural production yields about $31 per dollar spent for the program. So a 31-to-1 benefit
cost
ratio.
Quite a return. Wow. What do states east, do they have a say, and do we know whether, does the science tell us whether, cloud seeding to the west impacts what I see here east?
So this is something else that's been looked at many times through various studies in various locations. And what we can say about downwind effects are the effects might be counterintuitive to what people might think. We call this the, are we robbing Peter to pay Paul? That question that comes up. What cloud seeding does and what these studies have shown, if you're able to increase the precipitation in the target area where you intend the seeding effect to play out, there is some time and distance downwind that those clouds will still have that seeding effect carried with them as they travel downwind and away from the target area. So instead of a reduction in precipitation downwind, what we're actually seeing in the studies is a slight increase in precipitation for a time and distance downwind before the cloud goes back to its natural state.
Are there other uses that may not be top of mind? An example that we've thought about here is wildfires. So if there is wildfires in an area, there's a potential cloud system coming through that might be receptive to cloud seeding. Is it ever used for something like that?
That's something that has been discussed. I'm not sure that it's been actually conducted. I know in California, in the West, in the last few years, wildfires have been a serious issue. And there has been some discussion about the possibility of incorporating cloud seeding to try to help with that. One of the issues that you come up with wildfires, however, is they put a tremendous amount of smoke and soot particles in the atmosphere. And that has a terrible effect on clouds and the cloud's ability to produce precipitation. It kind of clogs them up and makes them difficult to produce precipitation that can fall. One thought is that cloud seeding may be able to help alleviate that a little bit, but it's not something that's being practiced currently. It's being discussed and theorized, but it's not being practiced.
What are the finances, Director, relative to North Dakota's cloud seeding program? And the bottom line, who pays for the program?
Well, the program from last summer, 2022, in the counties I referenced earlier, cost $738,000. That's for 5 airplanes to be on the program on call 24/7, the pilots and the personnel and the radars to do that work and to be on call. And the sponsoring counties pay 66% of those operational costs. And the state does cost share with the counties that do this work 34%. So the locals pay the lion's share of the operations costs. Most of the effects and benefits go directly to the counties. The state does cost share, but the state also does realize benefits when you see increased crop yields and the sales of those yields in those areas.
Are there counties that have concerns about this and have not implemented the program because of concerns, and what might they be?
Well, the program in North Dakota is purely a ground-up grassroots program. So the state regulates cloud seeding in North Dakota. We have licensing requirements for individuals or companies that may want to do this work. There's permitting requirements for areas that want to conduct operations. But the choice whether or not to participate in the program is solely up to the counties themselves. And then for them to include, you know, up to 66% of the operations costs. So I can't speak for the counties that aren't in the program necessarily, because we're not out, you know, promoting this program statewide. I think most people know that it's available and it's a program that's there. But the counties that are in it currently, many of them have been in it for several decades. And that's kind of how the program has been shaped here in North Dakota.
That said, do you anticipate expansion or about status quo moving forward?
The program has been mostly status quo. There have been times where we've added a county or two, or a county or two have left the program, you know, and that kind of depends on specific, you know, information or specific situations in those counties, whether a group, you know, decides that they want to try to join the program through a grassroots effort or leave it through a similar effort. And again, those decisions are left to the counties themselves.
You mentioned decisions that were made by the North Dakota legislature in 1965 and 1975. Where does the federal government chime in on any regulatory concern or efforts from either all states or North Dakota and its cloud seeding program?
As far as a regulatory framework, there's not a lot that the federal government requires. There is a reporting requirement, to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So, programs that operate cloud seeding are required to report the dates that they did the operations, the materials they used, things of that nature. But it's pretty basic in what the federal government requires. The regulatory framework for cloud seeding is largely handled by the states. And North Dakota, Colorado, Utah, all these Western states that are doing this work have very similar regulatory frameworks to deal with the programs in their areas.
This technology, as you've described, has been along for a while. Are there any technology changes or updates or discoveries that may change how this program is implemented in North Dakota?
I think there certainly are. Over the years, North Dakota has been involved heavily in research and development activities. There have been several research programs that have been conducted here in North Dakota over the years that have come out with new knowledge and technologies to try to do this kind of work. Actually, just recently here this month, there was a 3-day forum on rain enhancement technologies that was held in the United Arab Emirates. And there were several participants from many countries, including the U.S., at that conference. So interest in cloud seeding for enhancing precipitation is global. It's not just here in North Dakota or in the western part of the U.S.
One of the small things in my mind that just jumps out at me is the use of drones to impact maybe a faster response, maybe a less costly response in implementation of the program.
Drones are being looked at as a possible future delivery method for seeding materials. At this point, I think drones will maybe be used first for collecting data in the clouds and near the clouds where the activity would be conducted. One of the limitations of drones at this point is their size and their capability or their payload capacity. So that would be something that would need to be addressed probably just by using larger drones. But that is something that's being studied. The University of Colorado has got a several-year study ongoing on that project right now.
Director, your office has an interesting collaboration with the South Korean government regarding their intentions to start a cloud seeding program for rain enhancement. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so last August, we had a delegation of several scientists from the South Korean National Institute of Meteorological Sciences visit North Dakota. They spent some time in Fargo at Weather Modification International, which is a privately run company that does cloud seeding, in North Dakota and around the world, frankly. And they spent a day with us here at our offices in Bismarck and visited a couple of our field sites during the summer. And they're looking at trying to establish a rain enhancement cloud seeding operational program in South Korea. And they're wanting to have a collaborative relationship with our program here in North Dakota to learn, how we manage and how we operate our program here. And we're looking forward to working with them. We expect to have a scientist from South Korea to come and visit our program this summer for several weeks. Kind of job shadow us, learn what we do, how we do it, and visit all of our field locations and get a really good idea of how we operate here in North Dakota.
Director, you talked about other Western states who have done this for quite a while. What state is a model, if you will? Is North Dakota really the model for the country? Are we all learning from each other? What states do you look to understand how we're doing, so to speak?
I think North Dakota is a model. We're one of the earlier adopters of cloud seeding in the U.S. Another state that does similar kind of work to what we do here in North Dakota is Texas. They have a very large program in Texas, and their summertime operations similar to what we do here in North Dakota. New Mexico just started a program on the eastern border with Texas that's a summertime operation. And then when you get further west into California, Colorado, Idaho, Nevada, Oregon, Utah and Wyoming, now we're talking about wintertime operations where they're trying to put more snowfall on the mountain peaks, for various purposes, for increased runoff, for into the reservoirs or for municipal water supply or for irrigation. Or, there's Colorado ski resorts that fund cloud seeding just to put more snowflakes on their mountain ranges for skiers and snowboarders. Hydroelectric power companies are a longtime sponsor of cloud seeding programs to get additional runoff in the spring and to generate more hydroelectric power. So there are a number of sponsors and a number of reasons why cloud seeding is going on in the Western U.S.
Are there any ethical concerns that come to your office? Like, you know what? You really shouldn't be attacking Mother Nature in this way. Or it's just not right to try to do this in any other way that's not natural. How do you deal with those questions?
We hear the messing with Mother Nature refrain occasionally, yes. And my reply to that argument is that, you know, we as a human race have been messing with Mother Nature for thousands of years already. Whether we're diverting waterways for irrigation or to reduce flooding, or we're using fertilizer or herbicides on crops, or we're taking medicines for health issues, you know, these are just a few of many ways that we change what might be perceived as natural outcomes that benefit society. And I look at cloud seeding to modify precipitation no differently in that area.
Director, there's a program that has actually trained pilots to assist. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so the board, in conjunction with the Bureau of Reclamation early on and University of North Dakota's aviation program, developed a first-of-its-kind weather modification pilot training program back in the mid-1970s. And through that work, and now we have a memorandum of understanding with UND, longstanding, more than 400 intern pilots have been placed as co-pilots on the North Dakota Cloud Modification Project through 2022. It's been a very successful program, the only one like it in the world. And many of these pilots, after they get that experience as an intern, return to the project in North Dakota or other projects as pilots in command with more experience and more know-how to do what needs to be done to seed clouds.
Director, out of curiosity, do most of these flights generally take place when we are seeing thunderstorms develop in the afternoon, early evening? Or is this really a 24/7 thing? When do most of the flights happen?
It is a 24/7 thing because you can get thunderstorms any time of the day or night. But generally speaking, we kind of have that peak of activity in the late afternoon, early evening. And then another one maybe later in the evening if we have mature storms that are moving in off the foothills that developed in Montana earlier in the day. So we kind of have a bimodal peak, but it can happen anytime. We tell our pilots and our people, you know, it could be 3 in the afternoon or 3 o'clock in the morning and you might be working. When you're on a 24/7 on-call program, that's how it works.
Darren Langren is the director of the North Dakota Atmospheric Resources Board. Director, thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
I appreciate the time, Craig. Thank you.
You can hear this interview again on our website at prairiepublic.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens, Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, serving the Bismarck-Mandan area from homes and ranches to rental properties. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
Hey, lifelong learner, Humanities North Dakota is offering 6 12-week online classes taught by nationally recognized scholars. Class topics include Norse mythology, indigenous history, understanding the Constitution, Russian literature, and more. Registration and more information about North Dakota's lifelong learning community can be found at humanitiesnd.org.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the John and Elaine Andrist Charitable Trust, supporting the communities of Northwest North Dakota. Information at nwndcommunityfoundation.org.
Coming up next on Main Street, 529 plans are used for college savings, but starting next year, there's big changes. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. A House Appropriations Subcommittee is considering a proposed amendment to the higher education budget bill that would require a college or university to fully disclose its financial situation to finalists for that college's presidency. This comes as NDSU is working on cutting $10.5 million from its budget. NDSU President David Cook says that's due to a drop in enrollment. Cook took office on May 17, 2022. Fargo Republican Representative Steve Swantek proposed that amendment.
There would be more fuller transparency of the bigger picture, and that's okay. I mean, these individuals, that's not to say that they wouldn't continue with the discussion. They're probably the type of individual that would be up for a challenge. So I can't say specifically I do know that probably more information could have been provided to them.
Swantech says the candidates would also have to sign a non-disclosure agreement over those financial records. A bill brought before the House Education Committee would prevent state higher education institutions from waiving fees for any student based on race, sexual orientation, or gender identity. Representative Brandon Pritchard of Bismarck says House Bill 1531 aims to keep tax dollars from funding discriminatory scholarships.
I do not believe somebody's different than us because they have a different skin color. I don't believe somebody's different than us because they have a different sexual preference. And if you want to have a diversity of some form, it should be a diversity of ideas, which is an education system that we should all be behind.
Representative Lori Beth Hager of Fargo brought up concerns about the impact the bill would have on state and federal ethnicity-based programs, such as UND's Indians Into Medicine program, which helps natives enter the medical field and return to their communities.
I am very concerned that this bill that has a discriminatory tone to it will cost the university system millions and millions of aid that we are receiving from the federal government.
The committee took no further action at this time. And Governor Tim Walz made note of a possible lawsuit from North Dakota as he signed legislation making Minnesota carbon neutral by 2040. Minnesota utilities would have to be 100% carbon free by then. North Dakota is concerned that the law will keep North Dakota from exporting electricity from coal-fired power plants to Minnesota. Walz says he's confident that the law will withstand any legal challenge.
I trust that it will stand up because it was written to do exactly that. And just to be clear, Minnesota is not staking our future on coal and carbon, and I can't speak for our neighbors, but I think it would be more productive to join us and move the rest of the country in this direction. So I'm confident this will stand up. Unfortunate that they've chosen to go this direction, but the fact of the matter is Minnesota is moving into the future, and they're going to have to come sometime.
North Dakota's Industrial Commission, made up of the governor, attorney general, and agriculture commissioner, has authorized $1 million for legal action, and the legislature is considering another $3 million. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and we are going to talk now about money, and specifically a 4,000-page piece of legislation called Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement 2.0, or Secure 2.0. We are visiting now with Nick Peterson, a wealth advisor with Bell Investments. Nick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely, Ashley. Thank you for having me.
So I think one of the biggest changes that we'll see under Secure 2.0 is a change in 529 plans. This has historically been for college savings. And at the end, if there has been leftover money, you couldn't roll it into a retirement account. And
right.
Now people can. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, the funds were kind of stuck in these 529 accounts, if you will. You know, this is more for the kids than for the parents. You know, if the parents have been on the fence about starting a 529 because of that, you know, what if my kids don't go to college and I don't want the funds locked in this 529 account and not have access to it or even pay penalties for taking out funds for non-education-related expenses?
Because it's a 20% penalty at times.
Right. Yeah, 10 to 20% penalty based on, you know, what you're taking the funds out for. So now parents have the ability to, you know, still start contributing to these 529 accounts and have the ability to roll them out into a Roth IRA for the child so that they can, you know, continue to have these funds invested for retirement for the child in later years.
Okay. And only a Roth or different retirement accounts allowed?
The legislation right now says mainly for Roth IRA,
okay.
Particularly for the beneficiary of that 529 account.
Okay, so it couldn't go back to the parents
right.
or the caregivers.
Right.
Okay. What is the difference, really, between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA?
Yeah, I mean, the main difference between the two is how and when you want to get a tax break. Contributions to a traditional IRA are tax deductible, but when you start taking withdrawals in retirement, they are then going to be taxable. Where in comparison, contributions to a Roth IRA are not tax deductible, but the withdrawals in retirement are then going to be tax-free.
So you're working on the assumption that the tax rate will go
right,
up as you age.
Right.
Okay.
You know, in specific situations where if you think your tax rate's going to be higher in retirement, then Roth IRA should definitely be the way to go. If your tax rate's going to be higher currently, then, you know, traditional would be the way to go, get the tax break today.
Going back to the 529 plans and allowing the excess to be rolled over into a Roth IRA, people are humans. They love to game the system.
Right.
Could I put $3 million in a 529 plan and then roll that over into a Roth?
No. So there's still going to be a number of conditions that need to be satisfied with this new rule. So, you know, the 529 plan is going to have to be open for 15 years. Contributions made within the last 5 years are not eligible to be enrolled into that Roth IRA. The transfers into the Roth IRA account are going to be limited to annual Roth contribution limits. So like this year is $6,500. The lifetime transfer is going to be capped at $35,000.
So this is basically just to not penalize the parents or the children if there is any left over, but you should still presume that the 529 plan that you open is primarily going to be for college.
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
What would you advise parents right now, let's say looking at that 4 or 5 year period before they're starting at higher ed, based on what's changing in Secure 2.0, what do you advise those parents?
A lot of times these 529 accounts can be referred to as child IRAs as well, because in order to contribute to a Roth traditional IRA, you need earned income. And so unless you have some type of small business or business plan that you can, you know, put your kid on the payroll to have them part of contributions to a retirement plan, these are one way to start contributing to a plan that's going to grow tax deferred to benefit this child going forward.
Okay. When will this start to take effect?
So 2024 is going to be when the 529 to Roth account is going to be phased in.
Okay. Will there be changes after 2024?
There will be. Again, there's a lot of gray areas with this new act, so it's hard to say if there's going to be changes as far as that specific provision goes, but there will be a lot of changes over the next 10 years. You know, there's 90-plus provisions that are going to be put into place over the next 10 years, so there's definitely going to be a lot to come.
Okay, so this is the kind of thing where if somebody is looking to a wealth advisor, they might want to reach out now, maybe again in 6 months, maybe again in a year. Assuming that not everyone has been able to read this 4,000 pages of legislation?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Do we know yet what would happen if a child or the parents took the excess from the 529 plan, rolled it into a Roth, 5 years later decide to go back to college? Can it go back into a 529 plan?
I would have to assume it could. Again, that's one of the gray areas that I have yet to see a definitive answer on.
Okay. We're visiting today with Nick Peterson. He is a wealth advisor with Bell Investments. We are chatting about a Secure 2.0, and that stands for Setting Every Community Up for Retirement Enhancement. I wonder, too, Nick, is this the kind of thing, if you look at drilling rights, that will change under one administration, might be open to drilling in certain areas the next administration, not so much. Could this change after the next presidential election?
It could. Everything is always subject to change. However, there was a lot of bipartisan agreement on this legislation, so I would see that it would go into effect and people would be highly appreciative of the new legislation.
Now, we've been focusing primarily on this big change from the 529 plan into the Roth, rolling over that excess. What other kinds of changes are you most paying attention to for your clients?
Yeah, so some more popular, more important ones for this year, at least 2023. RMDs are being pushed back to age 73.
And what are RMDs?
Required minimum distributions, currently set at 72. So if you're turning 72 this year, or for 2022 anyways, your RMDs would have started.
Okay.
So now being pushed back to 73, you know, retirees can push that off one more year, not having to worry about having to pull funds out. And then it's going to be phased into age 75 for those born after 1960 by 2033. Something also for year 2023, Roth, SEP, and Roth Simple IRAs are now going to be allowed, which weren't previously. So it's going to give, you know, small business owners the ability to essentially have post-tax dollars rather than all pre-tax.
Hmm.
Penalty for missing RMDs is currently at 50%. If you, for some reason, miss taking out your RMD for the year, you're going to be penalized up to 50%, which is going to be reduced to 25 and even 10 if corrected in a timely manner. Things we're looking at for the following year as well, for 2024, student loan payments are going to be eligible for company matches. So if an employee is making loan payments and, you know, unable to put more money towards their 401k, those loan payments are going to be eligible to receive a company match in their 401k. RMDs from planned Roth accounts are going to be eliminated. So if participants have set all their contributions in their 401k to the Roth side of the plan,
mm-hmm.
there previously have been RMDs that needed to be taken from those plans, but that's going to be eliminated going forward here in 2024.
Wow.
So
this seems like a lot of really substantial changes. Do you have a sense of what really have been the driving forces behind this many changes in one piece of legislation?
I think there's been a lot of concern about not enough participation in retirement savings,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of people hoping or you know, defaulting on the fact that Social Security will be enough to live off of in retirement. So I think this is hopefully going to help incentivize individuals to start saving for retirement, or at least even start increasing their savings for retirement. And it also increases just the sheer access to workplace plans.
When you consider the number of changes under Secure 2.0, do you feel hopeful about the economy, or do you feel a little bit worried?
Yeah, I mean, I always feel hopeful about the economy. I mean, no one likes to think about the doomsday scenarios, right? But
I don't know. At 4 a.m., it's actually a real popular thought.
yeah. I can't disagree. But yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be better for everyone to have the ability to save more for retirement and have more access to have the ability to save for retirement. It's all going to benefit individuals in the future.
We talked briefly moments ago about the difference between a Roth IRA and a traditional IRA. But if I'm not mistaken, it is possible to convert one into the other. When would somebody want to start considering that?
Yeah, very good question. So, you know, in years like we had this year, the market was anywhere from, you know, 5 to 20% down, depending on, you know, what date you looked at. And so when you're wanting to convert, a good time to do that would be when, you know, your assets have decreased in value. So then when you're converting them, you're paying taxes on a lower dollar amount. And so, you know, as long as you don't sell them and you hold them and you're in the camp that the market's going to come back, then those assets are now in Roth post-tax dollars. So when you pull those out in retirement at a later date, they're already taxed. You don't have to be taxed again.
Hmm. What advice do you have for those people who want to be logging into their retirement accounts every day and watching the number jump up, jump down, jump up, fall down?
Yeah. If you want to lose sleep at night, it might be a good course of action. But as far as, you know, there's a lot of anxiety around the market this year. And I think, you know, if you don't know what to do, sometimes the best thing to do is do nothing and you know, just hold your investment, stick to the strategy, because, you know, these events, types of events have happened plenty of times in the history of the markets, and we continue to trend higher. So I think you originally enter into an investment strategy for a certain reason, and you are in to a five-year term, 10-year term, whatever it may be. So you just stick to the strategy. Don't make a rash decision and sell out.
Hmm. Do wealth advisors tend to focus, for example, would you only work with a client 20s to 30s and then advise them to grab somebody else 30s to 40s?
My client base is anywhere from, you know, kids just starting out with a Roth IRA, parents starting 529 accounts, rollover clients that are just leaving their careers and entering retirement with a bulk 401k balance. We're able to work with the whole gamut as far as client situation goes. And quite frankly, us at Bell Investments, we work as a team and constantly collaborate on certain situations. So we're able to work with pretty much anyone.
Hmm. What about this idea that people can be gifting money from their retirement accounts? What advice do you have for people? And when do you really want them to start focusing on something like that? Is it a matter of what age they're getting to be or a matter of how much is in the account?
Yes, there's a couple different options. So there's two different ways. There's qualified charitable distributions and basically just gifting IRA assets to friends, family, loved ones. So qualified charitable distributions or QCDs, basically a lot of times what people use those for is, you know, retirees that need to start taking their required minimum distributions. And they don't want to increase their taxable income. So they will directly donate those to a nonprofit church, a nonprofit or profitable organization of their choosing, to basically just have those assets go directly to them so that it doesn't increase their taxable income. As for gifting IRA assets to, you know, loved ones, friends, family, the IRA owner is going to be taxed on whatever dollar amount that they're gifting. However, they're also going to be subject to gift tax exclusion limits. So, like for last year, 2022, $16,000 is going to be the gift tax exclusion limit, and then they're increasing that to $17,000 for 2023.
We're visiting today with wealth advisor from Bell Investments, Nick Peterson, just getting some financial advice. Nick, what are your investment strategies for clients during a time of high inflation?
Yeah, the best option is just keeping a percentage of your assets in a diversified portfolio. And so for a lot of times, we're looking at diversified portfolios on a investor's risk tolerance. So we always got to be cognizant of that. And so, you know, if someone's younger looking for growth, there's growth diversified portfolios with, you know, more allocation to stocks and equities. If someone's more conservative, we're going to have portfolios that are designed for a more conservative investor with more fixed income or bond investments. You know, things that have been popular this year, savings bonds, I-bonds, things that keep up with the rate of inflation. Other things that have been kind of top of mind, just quality dividend-paying stocks, ETFs, mutual funds that are investing in more of the value side of the market. Again, dividend-paying investments. Commodities tend to do well in rising inflation environments, which we've seen a lot of this year.
What is your process as you are meeting with clients for establishing risk tolerance and risk aversion?
Yeah. So we, you know, go through a few questions to ask them, you know, how would you feel if we went through a market like 2008, 2009? Would you be okay with a 20-30% loss?
That was a big bubble bursting year.
Right. And obviously a lot of people were kept up at night because of that. Mm-hmm. And so we like to try to put them in that scenario because it does happen. I mean, we're seeing a little bit of that just last year here. So we like to, you know, base off of that type of scenario because it can happen again, and we don't want someone to be in a situation that they don't appreciate.
So there is kind of this rule of thumb that when you're younger, you can be riskier in your investments because you have a lot more time to recover from losses. As someone gets closer and closer to retirement, if they are staying more risk tolerant than maybe you would advise, is it your job to just do what the client wants, or is it your job to try to convince them do it this way instead?
I think it's more of our job to advise them on, you know, what would be the right situation or what would be the right thing to do based on their needs. However, you know, if they're willing and able to stay more aggressive than what the average person might think, it ultimately comes down to their decision. However, if it is so aggressive that it's almost unethical, you know, we would maybe ask them to either do it on their own or consult another advisor. We would never want to put ourselves in that type of situation.
What tips do you have, Nick, for people who want to be investing in what's called socially conscious or socially responsible investments? What if somebody comes to you and says, I don't want to invest in tobacco or in places that are destroying rainforests, for example?
Yeah, it's becoming a much more popular thing these days, and it's still a relatively new phenomenon. You need to know what you own. I mean, there's a myriad of investment options out there claiming to invest based on environmental, social, governance factors, which another name for it's ESG. But looking under the hood, some of those products may be surprising to investors. So a good thing to do and a couple of resources that we use that you can essentially put the ticker in of the fund stock to review how it does across a variety of social impact measures. One is asyousow.org. And another one is sustainalytics.com. And it'll help you get a much more thorough review of what that fund is actually investing in.
Can somebody come to you with $50? Or do you need to have 10, 20 grand to play with?
No, I mean, we're able to help anyone. There's no right client. There's no size of client that we need to have in order to help or do business with. I think it's smart for anyone to at least get their toes wet. It's a very daunting industry looking at it from outside, and there's easy ways to get involved, and it doesn't have to be so difficult.
For a generation or two, you would hear stories of women who, if they lost their significant other, could sometimes be at a loss for money management, and they would say things like, well, my husband just took care of that. Are we still running into that?
No, I wouldn't say there's really a difference between male and female clients. I think just clients in general are very different. What we like to say is clients are like snowflakes. Everyone's completely different.
Nick Peterson, wealth advisor with Bell Investments. Thanks so much for your time today.
Absolutely, Ashley. I appreciate it. Thank you very much for your time.
Dakota Datebook is next.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 8th. On this date, in 1983, the Bottineau Current reported on a recent visit by Tiny Tim, the quirky singer and ukulele player. He was quite famous at the time, having made a name for himself with his signature song, Tiptoe Through the Tulips. He performed two concerts at the Antler School to raise money for the school district. Around 250 people attended. He took the stage in a tuxedo that had comic book characters on it, along with a red and white tie and blue and white sneakers. He strummed his ukulele and sang with his falsetto voice such songs as I've Been Working on the Railroad, Hail, Hail, The Gang's All Here, She's a Grand Old Flag, 5 Foot 2, Eyes of Blue, and concluded the show with God Bless America, which brought the audience to their feet as they sang along. According to the newspaper, the audience cheered for more. Tiny Tim complied, performing Elvis Presley songs and imitating the king with gyrations and clothes slinging. After the Elvis interpretations, the crowd yelled for Tiny Tim to sing Tiptoe Through the Tulips. The song brought the audience to their feet with a standing ovation, ending the concert. In reality, it wasn't all tulips that evening, because the performer had arrived in Antler without a winter jacket, and he was fighting a cold, causing his voice to crack. However, it didn't stop him from entertaining the fans, who danced and clapped along. Although Tiny Tim gave a great performance, the concerts didn't end well for the school, which lost money in the venture. No small thing, since the district already faced cuts in state foundation payments. Then there was a fan from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, who wasn't impressed with the superintendent of schools, who gave Tiny Tim a key to the city. The fan was quoted in the newspaper saying the superintendent should have given Tiny Tim a jacket instead of a lousy key. Tiny Tim expressed sadness that he hadn't raised the hoped-for money, but one resident reassured him, saying, "You've done more for this city than you can possibly imagine." Tiny Tim must have left an impression, because years later, the people still talk about the concert, his kindness, and what he tried to do for their schools. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Scott Wager. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
I hope that the listeners on Prairie Public tune into the Thomas Jefferson Hour, because I believe that we need to lift the idea of civilization and civility and culture, that we need, in a sense, to rise to the occasion of being what Jefferson had in mind for this civilization, and that the only way to do that is to be self-conscious about it and to work together to create the conditions under which we know we would be happier, more fulfilled, and more enlightened. And I think that the Jefferson Hour, in the broad world of public radio, is an important niche in which that project finds voice and creates a community of people who want to live in a more enlightened world than the one we happen to be born into.
Join Clay Jenkinson for the Thomas Jefferson Hour, Sundays at 11 a.m. Central, 10 a.m. Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Jack Russell Weinstein as he previews the upcoming episode of The Why Show, The Power of Privacy, what we all should consider in this high-tech world. Tom Ezern will share a Plains Folk essay, In the West, and it's almost time for the big game between Kansas City and Philadelphia. How's your snack game? Sue Balcom is here for a football edition of Main Street Eats. Remember, you can hear all episodes of Main Street on our website at prairiepublic.org. Thanks for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your day.